Hello and welcome to this episode of the Global Innovators in Business series. In this series, we bring leaders and innovators from different fields to share their advice and experiences with undergraduate students to provide inspiration and motivation during the pandemic. We're so happy to have with us Mr. Jeffrey Garrett. Jeffrey Garrett is the Robert R. Doxson Dean's Chair in Business Administration at the USC Marshall School of Business. He previously served as the Dean of the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania for 6 years. This full interview is dedicated to the Southern California Counseling Center with a mission to change lives and strengthen communities by providing affordable mental health care to people in need. It helps provide extremely affordable counseling led by volunteers. Learn more with the link in the description. Also, feel free to comment any questions you have for Dean Garrett below, and we will open a Q&A later in the interview. So thank you so much for being here, Dean Garrett.
It's my pleasure to be with you, Christopher, and it's great to see you again.
So first, we always start with the nonprofit that he chose to dedicate this interview to. Why did he choose the Southern California Counseling Center?
Yeah, really two reasons. One is my wife has been developing her own psychotherapy practice, and you have to do a lot of hours to be credentialed in California. And she worked at the SCCC, as it's known, for 3 years. So I got an insider view of this incredible institution that provides very low cost, very high quality, but ongoing mental health care, you know, outside an insurance framework. In an insurance framework, you might get 4 sessions or 6 sessions. At the center, you can have a therapist for years. And they've been able to do that for 50 years with no insurance, no government support. Incredible institution. But I think in 2020, given the fact that we're all experiencing mental health challenges, I think it's important just to underscore that reality, that for all of us, things are happening in COVID that maybe we don't see at the surface, but below the surface, we're all being stressed. We're all anxious. We're being told that other people are scary and dangerous. I just think we all need to be taking better care of our own mental health and being so aware of everybody else. You know, I think the two most important words that I try to practice in the pandemic are be flexible about everything and be compassionate about everything. And I think SCCC is a really good example of that.
I think one of the articles you posted was one of the highest growing apps during this pandemic was Calm, which is based off of mental health. And this is always the two words that so many students don't want to talk about, but is affecting our everyday lives. So
And let me just say in that regard, not only was, I think that category was health and fitness, right? So it could have been Peloton or workout, but it was about serenity and mental health. But then I think I saw in the NBA finals that LeBron James was one of the endorsers for Calm, right? Talk about real crossover. So that will show you, I think, how pervasive the mental health challenges we're all facing are. Mm-hmm. And all I would say to the students who are listening in today is, you know, there is no stigma about mental health, right? I mean, wellness is essential for all of us. I think you've heard me say, Christopher, that I think recharge, recovery, knowing when you're running on empty is critically important for all of us. You know, there's this old cliche, it's a marathon, not a sprint. Somebody once said to me, no, that's absolutely wrong about the contemporary world. The contemporary world is a series of sprints. And if you're going to keep sprinting well, you've got to recover. You'll remember when I took the stand to close a building at Wharton in the middle of the night because I didn't want students to feel it was a badge of honor to fall asleep over their laptop at 3 a.m. You know, you're not being productive doing that. Let's listen to our bodies and to our minds and figure out that we've got to take care of ourselves. If we're in it for the long run, if we're going to sprint every day, we've just got to take care of ourselves. So I think it's an incredibly important message.
100%. And definitely check out the link and then even consider volunteering for the organization and helping others as well. So we're going to be starting with a little bit of your backstory. You grew up in Australia, and I know from a young age, your goal was to become a Rhodes Scholar, and then you tried to apply for the Rhodes Scholar, and then you weren't able to get it. And I think I'm speaking for all of us in that a lot of us have experienced these journeys of something that we really want to do, our dream being shattered. And it's extremely tough and difficult of a challenge. So how did you overcome that? And what was the story?
Yeah, so Christopher, I mean, this is a really important story in my life. But let me say that, I think you know this, I've just been so impressed with the perspective that you and other undergraduates have today on your lives. And you set big goals, you think about how to get there. I actually wasn't like that at all, right? I grew up in Canberra, I went to the local university in Canberra, and I just happened to be a pretty good athlete. And so if you were an athlete and you were in university, the thing to aspire to was to be a Rhodes Scholar, because, you know, I think today Rhodes Scholars tend to be more people who've done big things in the world, you know, like you, not-for-profits and the like. But back then, this is 35 years ago, at least in Australia, the ticket to being a Rhodes Scholar was being good enough to be a varsity athlete in Oxford. And I was probably, you know, maybe a borderline athlete, but I just wasn't a good enough student. You said it was, you know, a big plan of mine for a long time. That wasn't true. I started focusing on this as a, what am I going to do after I finish university? I didn't know. I didn't have a big plan. This looked like an attractive pathway. I mean, it was a mythical pathway. But you're right, I didn't get it. And that was a big deal, because then my Australian undergraduate advisor had gone to get a PhD in the United States. And he said to me, this is a great opportunity for you. You can go to the US, do a PhD, and critically for me, that I could probably get a fellowship that would pay for my education. So even then, all I was thinking was, and this is a classic Australian move, you want to go and live in the big world outside. And if somebody was going to pay me to be a student in the US for 3, 4, or 5 years, I thought, wow, that's fantastic. You know, I can go to America. I can learn about everything that the US is. Obviously, it's a mythical country for everyone around the world. But then I just assumed I'd go back to Australia and work in the Australian government, you know, like my father did for every day of his working life, and as my sister and brother have done for all of their working lives. The transformative moment was that I fell in love with research when I was in the US. And, you know, that's the thing that changed my life. And so the punchline back to Rhodes Scholar is, literally 5 years after I wasn't good enough to be a Rhodes Scholar, I was back in Oxford teaching the Rhodes Scholars. When I look back on that, that's kind of unbelievable that that would happen to me. But I really credit it to American higher education, the quality of American higher education, and the fact that American higher ed has been, as the US has been a magnet for talented, ambitious people from all over the world, you know, for 150 years. So that's why subsequently my whole life has really been around my twin passions of all things global and all things higher education.
From that point on, I think you've been a leader in this perspective of global business and in higher ed. But I think going into, you were a Fulbright Scholar instead of a Rhodes Scholar, but after a few years in academia, you went on this path of research. And I'm very curious, what is the one question throughout your career that you found most challenging through research?
Well, the big question that all of my work as a political scientist basically was about was, what was the mismatch between the increasing globalization of markets and the national scale of politics? What was that mismatch going to mean? Were global markets going to overwhelm everything and all countries would become the same? Would countries be able to chart different pathways through globalization? Questions like that were the ones that motivated me. I started thinking about that very much in the context of Europe. And the simple question was, could the European welfare state survive globalization? And I gave, I think, a somewhat nuanced answer to that, which looks pretty good in retrospect, but for a while it was touch and go. And my answer was that Northern Europe, Germany, Sweden, Denmark, Netherlands, would do pretty well in global markets because they understood that they needed to be export economies, but they were going to compete on quality, not on price. And so what they did was invest very heavily in what we would now call the human capital of the countries. Whereas I said that Southern Europe, which was trying to compete on price, you know, Greece, Italy, Spain, was going to be challenged by the rise of less developed countries. And of course, now we know that was above all China. So I had this kind of bifurcated argument that you could actually be a pretty left-leaning, pro-labor, pro-welfare state country, so long as you understood that you had to invest in human capital because you were going to compete on quality, not on price. So that was the kind of argument. And then after I did that for a little while, there were all these changes in Europe, the European Union. So I then started asking the same kind of question now, but with this unique political form of the EU being formed. And all this was happening in real time while I was studying it.
When was this?
This period, I started doing this work in about 1985. And I did it pretty consistently to the end of the 1990s. So obviously, you know, actually not obviously to young people, but to me, it's obvious that the 1990s were an extraordinary decade of change, right? The Cold War ended, many countries became democratic, and global markets were everywhere. And I think for, you know, for people trying to understand the US or for Americans, that decade was an understandable kind of we won decade for the US, that all the things that you would have read in civics books about the value of markets, the value of democracy, they were literally all coming true on the global stage right in front of your eyes, right? So I think the 1990s was an incredibly positive decade for the US and actually for the world. But I think it probably made us naively complacent. Right. And so subsequently we had first the backlash, the terrorism backlash and 9/11 and the war on terrorism and all that in the 2000s. But then subsequently we've had this anti-globalization sentiment that, you know, that increasingly characterized the last 10 years, but I think is even more intense today. So for me, you know, understanding the yin and the yang of globalization through a politics lens, you know, that's been the consistent thing in my life, at least my life as a scholar.
That's so interesting. I mentioned a time because just last year, I think you also went to China, but the Wharton hosted a trip to China. And one of the main conversations we had with the manufacturers of different industries is they were saying that they're trying to shift more from a quantity basis to a quality basis. And this is from 1985, 35 years later, and it's still the same kind of trend happening. And very interesting that the same story continues.
But yeah, and I do think, I'm so glad you went on that trip. And I remember being in Southern China and feeling the supply chain challenges, you know, associated with tensions between the US and China and the opportunity in Vietnam and all of that stuff. But one broader thing that I've certainly wanted to say to people about China who aren't watching China so closely is that China as low-cost manufacturer to the world, that's now pretty old in China. You know, it started, as you know, it started in Guangdong province. Well, now Guangdong province is the most developed part of China. Labor costs are high, per capita income is high, housing's expensive. It's not a low-cost location. So it's evolved in China is that China went from being a low-cost manufacturer and assembler to becoming a market because of hundreds of millions of people entering the middle classes. And, you know, so we have something like the fact that, you know, what is it? There are 3,000 Starbucks in China today. So China is market. But then there became China as innovator. And obviously we're seeing that today with Huawei, 5G, TikTok, all of that stuff. And then I think there's a fourth China, which is how is China going global? And we tend to think, I think the normal reaction is to view China as going global in a pretty traditional way, which is based on military power. And people look at the rise of the Chinese Navy, et cetera. But what I see is that China's going global, what I would call geoeconomically, not geopolitically. China's going global through trade and investment, not the traditional way, which is through military power. Yes, China's increased military expenditures a lot, but I think the distinctive feature is this trade and investment move, and it is literally global. I mean, if you look at Africa, for example, Chinese investment and trade in Africa has been mushrooming in the past 15 years. At the same time as American investors, for example, think that Africa is still a bit too risky. So the US has probably been disinvesting from Africa. Well, China hasn't. It's been doubling down, and it's been trying to do it in a win-win way for other economies, which is to focus on the fact that Chinese infrastructure is world-class. And China needs to have good infrastructure in Africa because it wants to, you know, it wants to get minerals and other things out of the ground. Well, you need good ports and railways and roads to do that. So it's a win-win. But infrastructure, as you know, is a key to development everywhere. And most emerging markets, frankly, don't have very good infrastructure. And so China has decided, hey, we can provide it for you. In a way that's good for us, no doubt, but it's also good for you. And that's a distinctive feature, I think, of China's go global strategy.
At what point in history, in the 1990s, did this increase in globalization happen? Why did China become the center of this?
It's a really good question. And I think if you try to distill it to two reasons, one reason is just the strategic focus, long-term time horizon of the Chinese government, which is powerful, disciplined, centralized. So they always had a serious plan, and the plan wouldn't get buffeted by, you know, small changes in the global economy or by domestic political changes. There was always a long-term view. So I think the most distinctive feature from a policy standpoint about the Chinese political system is just the long-term strategic nature of thinking. But that could only happen if the rest of the world was willing to welcome China into the global system. And that's where the US played a critical role. You know, I think it's fair to say that Bill Clinton, when he was president of the US for much of the 1990s, was China's champion to enter the global economy through the World Trade Organization. But if we now go from that time, 2000, to today, Bill Clinton said to the American people, I want China in the WTO because it'll change China. It'll make China a democracy. And obviously now the Trump administration says, well, that was just wrong, right? You let China into WTO. You said it would change China. It hasn't changed China. Therefore, we should have a very different strategy, right? That's the core position, I think, of the Trump administration. And, you know, my feeling going forward is that the U.S., I still think the U.S. benefits enormously from lots of engagement with China, you know, not only economically, but people to people, college students, universities, incredibly important. But I think the US is going to have a different framing for why engagement with China is so important. And I don't think it can be, we're going to change China, which was the view for a long period of time. So if you don't have that as the justification, how do you support a China engagement strategy? And I certainly, you know, this is the position I hold. I think we need to be more open to the reality that, yes, US-China has benefited China economically, no question, but it's also benefited Americans. First by more and cheaper goods, but now by the rise of the Chinese market. So I think we need to have a more sophisticated understanding of how the global economy actually works and how the US benefits from globalization in general, but from economic exchange with China in particular. But then the second point I'd make is a very old geopolitical one that the philosopher Immanuel Kant first made, which is that, you know, there are going to be frictions between countries and political systems, particularly when you've got an incumbent power and a rising power, the way we have with US and China today. Kant said, if you do more economic exchange, you've got more to lose with military conflict. So I think the ultimate reason for engagement between US and China is we hear a lot about a second Cold War. The Cold War between the US and the Soviet Union was only possible because the two systems were completely disengaged economically. I think it's the engagement, the economic engagement between US and China that's created political stability. So yes, there are disagreements, but both sides have an incentive to manage down the disagreements. I worry if we decouple, that incentive will go away.
So you're saying that because there are so much economic ties between China and the United States and the rest of the world, that limits the amounts of aggression that one country can have on the other, because they're also hurting their own economy by taking the shot.
Yeah, and this is obviously a very important question, and there are different perspectives on it. Mm-hmm. So I should just say, for people who've taken a class about the first era of globalization in the early 20th century, people say, well, it's just wrong that economic interconnections stopped war, because Germany and the UK went to war in 1914, even though they did a lot of trade. And that's true. But I actually think that the distinctive feature of this contemporary globalization, and I think you're right to start it in about 1985, is multinational companies with global supply chains and global distribution networks. And I think that creates this kind of dense thicket of interactions that did not exist 100 years ago. So I think the economic ballast that economic interactions provide, the geopolitical stability they provide, is much greater today than was the case before World War I.
That brings us to today, where, as you heard from yesterday's debate, I think both candidates on both sides are very, very politically, not so much trade-wise, but very anti-China. And there is a strong sentiment in both parties. What is behind this message, and why do you think this is a growing sentiment?
Anytime there would be an economic challenger to the US, you'd get opposition to that. So that was true, again, 35 years ago. That was true with Japan. One difference between Japan and China is that Japan was not a military rival of the United States, right? It was an economic rival back then, but it wasn't a military rival. And if, you know, again, you and other college students weren't alive at the time, there was a lot of anti-Japanese sentiment in the 1980s. China is bigger and more powerful economically than Japan was. And the US views it as its only potential geopolitical military rival. So it's a 1-2 punch of a serious economic competitor with a military rival against the backdrop of two completely different political systems. So, you know, you put all those three factors together, and it's understandable that there's a lot of concern about China's rise, which is why I think we need to go back to the foundational building blocks of why engage with China. And as I said before, the one that Bill Clinton championed, we want China in WTO because it'll make China a democracy. I don't think that's the justification anymore. We need to have a different base for the US, the overall framing of the US approach to China. And as I said, I'd focus on the genuine economic benefits that we can talk about from access to the Chinese market, plus the role that China plays in global supply chains on the one hand, and on the other hand, this notion that economic entanglement creates geopolitical stability. So I really do think we've got to go back to close to square one, because otherwise Joe Biden is signaling that even if his one-liner on China would be something like, Donald Trump was right to be tough on China. I'm just going to work with the allies to do it, right? That's his core approach. It's not Trump was wrong to take on China. It was just that he did it the wrong way by not engaging our allies. So, you know, I think that's politically smart of Biden in the campaign. But I also think that'd be pretty close to what a Biden policy would look like. It would still be get tough with China. It would be, you know, more nuanced, less Trumpy than the last 4 years, but not so different. So, I think we, acknowledging that, I think we just need to go back to square one and think about what China means to the world and what China means to the US. That's a big challenge, a big question. But I think it's one that we've got to take on because, you know, obviously China and the US are the two most important countries in the world by a long way on most dimensions. And if they don't get on well together, that's not only not good for the US and China, that's not good for the whole world.
The biggest way to see the problems or the challenges between anything is when there's a large event that's unprecedented. And I think COVID-19 is a great example of that. Well, what do you think COVID-19 means to the relationship of the supply chains, globalization, and going forward?
So much to say there, Christopher, because you're right. It's a profound, profound event. Let me just say that I have two overall takes on coronavirus. The first one is that it's accelerating a lot of trends that were already there. Work from home, online education, maybe deglobalization, shortening supply chains. So lens one on the crisis, it's accelerating trends. Lens two for me is just the dramatic contrast between this crisis and the last great global crisis, which was the financial crisis in 2008-2009. That period, the financial crisis, was one characterized by incredible coordination of policies across the world. But the two biggest countries that collaborated and coordinated were the US and China. Yes, the US did an enormous stimulus to help the US recovery in 2009-10, but exactly the same was true for China. And certainly I know for my home country of Australia, it was the Chinese stimulus that really saved or helped the Australian economy bounce back from the financial crisis. So that was international coordination. It's an every country for itself and every other country is a problem mindset today. And I think we should be worried about that. I think, you know, I would hope that a reset that could happen in 2021 is that we just move from criticizing each other over how we've handled the coronavirus to working together, both to manage down the virus, let's hope in the context of a vaccine, but also to get economic recovery, strong economic recovery throughout the world.
Wow, those are great perspectives. And at Wharton, you helped put together the largest class Wharton had regarding COVID-19. It took 3 days and you brought in some of the best professors across different places at Penn and beyond. From your perspective, what do you think is the future role of higher education and institutions after COVID-19? Would it mean that there is more consolidation or maybe more virtualization or more online education?
Big topics. Let me just say two things. First, the Wharton class that you took, Christopher, it was really, you know, my role was asking Mauro Guillen to lead the class, and then he did an incredible job, but I was so happy to participate in the class. My motivation for asking him was that I just believe our education, yes, it's rigorous, and the foundation, the academic foundation for what we provide is incredibly strong, but we've just got to be relevant too. And I thought this was an opportunity for us to demonstrate our relevance in real time, that you could have, you know, you could have an expert like Zeke Emanuel, who was, you know, Obama's right-hand person on healthcare, telling us in real time how the pandemic was playing out. You know, this is an extraordinary opportunity. So rigor plus relevance, I think that's got to be the value proposition of business schools, but I think of higher education more generally. The second part of the question, what's the future? My reaction to that is to say that up until now, we've thought, you know, in the past decade, we've thought there was something called on campus, and then there was something called online. I think after the pandemic, it's going to be much more of a continuum, and we'll have technology. Technology will be more important even to an on-campus education. And the way I think about that is that maybe there are some things we can now do remotely, probably things that look more like lectures that work really well in an online environment. But what we should do is then focus on what's magical and unique about face-to-face. And I think that is smaller group, more interactive, more problem-solving, more team-oriented, right? So I don't think COVID-19 is, you know, the end of on-campus education, far from it. I think that there will be a lot more online education because of all the cost pressures, cost and convenience. But great on-campus schools like Penn are going to thrive. I just think they'll use technology even more to enrich the on-campus experience than was the case in the past.
Do you think there has been a mindset shift in the academic community on online education?
I think for all of us, right? We were, if you'd asked the question hypothetically, could most universities in the US conduct entire remote semesters? Mm-hmm. People would have laughed at you and said, that is literally impossible. It's inconceivable. Well, we've now done it, right? So necessity is the mother of invention. That we had to do it. We had no choice. But now that we've done it, I think it will open up people's mindsets so that we can be more open-minded to uses of technology in higher education. But again, not in a way that is bad for on-campus. I think it can enrich on-campus, again, by a kind of division of labor idea. Let's do online what is most effective online, and let's save on campus for the really magical stuff. Smaller, team-oriented, problem-solving, applied, all of that. I think that's the way we're going to go.
What are two books you would recommend students to read?
I get asked this question a lot, and I have to admit that even though I read a lot, I mostly read media and what's happening right now, and I don't have a lot of time for more extended reads. But having said that, since we've been talking about politics and we've been talking about China, I'll make two recommendations. The first one is Elizabeth Economy's book. I think it's called The Third Revolution on Xi Jinping's China since 2012. You know, it's a somewhat critical book about Xi with respect to authoritarianism and human rights, but it gives you a really good window into China as innovation economy as well. So that's one recommendation. The second one is a pure politics book about the United States by a journalist called Ezra Klein. And I think the book's called Why We're Polarized. And Ezra makes the point that right now, if you know where somebody stands on any issue, you know where they stand on every issue. And that wasn't always the case. It used to be the case that a lot of issues cut across each other, but now they're all reinforcing. And, you know, I think that helps explain why our politics is so dialed up right now.
And then the question we always ask at the end of the interview is, amidst COVID-19, amidst the pandemic, what is your advice for students to get through this or to see in the future?
Let's end where we started. Think about your own wellness and your own mental health. And, you know, let me make it very concrete just by telling you how I operate on a daily basis. You know, I think I throw myself into my job. I think I work hard. But I also know at the end of the day, my performance starts to deteriorate. So I monitor for myself when I start, when I know I'm not concentrating as well, when I know I'm making mistakes. And I've always maybe been selfish in this way. I don't want to be working when I'm not working at my best, right? I don't like feeling at 50% or something like that. So I monitor for myself how I'm performing. And when I'm not performing, I give myself a wellness break. And again, I think, you know, we all recharge our batteries in different ways. For me, I like working out at the end of the day, not the beginning of the day. It revives me. But then I like, you know, sitting down and having something to eat and drink with my wife and maybe, you know, watch some sports or binge watch on TV for a few hours. You know, I tend, and I don't know whether people will think I'm lazy, but, you know, I think I tend to start working at about 6 o'clock in the morning. I like to stop working by about 6 o'clock in the evening. And if I can do a productive 12-hour day and then switch off for 4 hours and spend time with my wife, by the time 6 a.m. rolls around again, I'm ready to go, and I'm ready to go back at 100%. So for me, I know I've got to monitor myself that way, and I know I've got to be good to myself in the break sense. And I you know, my only worry about overachieving students like you is that you just think more work is always better. I just don't think it's true, right? Remember, life for you is a series of sprints. The only way to keep sprinting well is to recover between the sprints. You don't get it that what's the biggest risk you all face? It's burnout. Burnout on a weekly basis, monthly basis, yearly basis. You know, measure it however you like. The reason you're subject to burnout is because of all the pressure you're putting on yourselves. So if you can just be kind to yourself and monitor how you're feeling and then give yourself a break, give yourself a wellness break, I don't think that's being selfish. And I think it's really good for productivity, right? I mean, it's good for your psychology, it's good for your wellness, but I think it's also good for your productivity. You actually work better, don't work longer.
That's such great advice. Angela Duckworth, when she was given a speech, she said, the biggest threat is every day just blends into each other and there's no schedule. And it's just over and over and over again. But setting that schedule, having a 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. working session, keeping yourself healthy and motivated is so important. So thank you, Dean Garrett. This is a pleasure. Thank you so much for listening. And make sure to check out more content and subscribe to our podcast.